welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast, Episode 3, The Face That Launched a Thousand Ships, Part 1, Helen of Sparta. Helen, it's a name that has rung out down the ages and been the watchword for beauty unsurpassed, but also betrayal. Let's tick that beauty off straight away. The epithets used by our epic poets only ever refer to her as shining, radiant, and the daughter of Zeus. The closest we get to a physical description in the epics is Homer referring to her as white-armed Helen. I'm inclined to believe this is more due to her being raised in the covered palace surrounds of Sparta and could have been a parochial term used generally to set nobles apart from the field workers who would have been tanned by the sun. In Indian culture today, fairness of skin indicates a privileged position and skin, sun-browned, a background of peasantry, and I see no reason why the same couldn't be said of Mycenaean culture. We must wait almost 2,000 years before anyone comes close to a physical description, when Quintus of Smyrna describes her dark blue eyes in the 4th century CE. It's almost as if ancient composers and authors knew something the various men who encountered her didn't, that to understand something of her physical perfection was to court disaster, that there was something inherently dangerous in the gaze of the face that launched a thousand ships. The name itself has defied clear-cut definition and has given etymologists a headache in trying to pin down, just like her nature, its true meaning. In Greek, she is Eleni, a pronoun that so closely resembles the Greek word for the people of Greece, Elenes, that it begs comparison. That would, however, be too easy, and our mercurial subject offers other, just as elusive explanations. There is a theory that she is in fact the embodiment of an ancient goddess of the moon, given form by the antecedents of Homer. Supporting that is the similarity of her name Eleni to the Greek word for the moon, Selene. Since ancient times, the Earth's lunar companion has been closely linked with fertility, an important focus for the veneration of Helen. I have even read theories linking the name to early Indo-European sun deities, which fits nicely with another definition of the name meaning shining or bright. It seems something Hesiod picks up on in his calling her Shining Helen. This multifaceted form of explanation carries over into the interpretation of the epitome of womanhood. Throughout the classical age of Greece and into the Roman period, the cults that worshipped some aspect of her existence were legion and sprung up all over the Mediterranean. One of the most important was a large sanctuary dedicated to her on Rhodes, which worshipped her as Elena Dendrites, Helen of the Trees, reinforcing her ancient links with vegetation and fertility. For women in those times, she represented the font of femininity, fecundity, refinement, and radiance, whilst for the misogynist males of antiquity she was everything they feared most in the opposite sex, the one who appeared flippant in her pursuit of lust and love, she who could never rest in her affection but who they all wanted to possess and control. As the years turned into generations, and the generations into epochs, so too did her representation shift. During the Renaissance, the rape or abduction of Helen became the inspiration for many works of art depicting her in various scenes and states of lamentation as she is marched, dragged, and carried from her Spartan home by Paris. The story is often one told in very broad strokes, unlike the detailed brushwork used by Italian and French artists of the period. The Italian painter Francesco Primaticcio, painting the abduction in the 16th century, has our subject in a pose of languish, being carted off by her captor towards a waiting ship bound for Troy. Aphrodite, all the while, watches on, directing Paris towards his destiny and destination. Another Italian by the name of Luca Giordano depicts a wriggling, writhing Helen attempting to thwart the designs of Paris to remove her from her husband, daughter, and homeland of Sparta. The message is clear from these works of high art. Helen did not go willingly, yet the image we have of her today is one far different. The Hollywood blockbuster Troy, in 2004, portrays her as only too willing to receive the advances of Paris and escape the clutches of her much older husband, Menelaus. From the beginning, the character is besotted with Orlando Bloom's sparkling brown eyes, and it appears as a love match in the truest sense. Her name carries weight in the world of modern marketing too, with 2018 marking the 50th anniversary of the company called Helen of Troy, a global consumer products organization that has a diverse portfolio of health, housewares, and you guessed it, beauty products. Over the millennia, she has been many things to a great many people, the ultimate feminine chameleon. The story of Helen's life is not one that can be contained, constricted nor confined merely within the pages of the Iliad and the Odyssey. When we first meet Helen in Book 3 of the Iliad, we are told nothing about this almost archetypical definition of womanhood or her life up to that point. She is simply sitting at the loom, weaving. In fact, she only appears a grand total of 6 times in the Iliad, and in the Odyssey, she has only one significant scene. This isn't an oversight on Homer's behalf. When he introduces her, the story of the most beautiful woman in the world is already one very well known by the audience in attendance. The legend of Helen is ancient by the time of the Iliad's composition, and Homer saw no need in reintroducing her life up to that point. Therefore, basing her biography on his works alone would only be painting a mere fraction of the whole picture. So, in order to create as rounded a biography as I can, the literary scope of reference needs to broaden significantly, and before I dive into the life of Helen, I'd like to talk a little first about the source material I'll be using. Much of what I intend to say is going to come from works outside of the Homeric traditions. It's important to understand where exactly this information was first propagated. Helen lived during what Homer's contemporary Hesiod referred to as the Age of Heroes, and there was an epic cycle of works that came out of that period as oral history into the archaic and classical periods of ancient Greece. This age spanned roughly 6 generations and was a time when divine, semi-divine, and mortal individuals interacted so closely as to have almost dwelt within the same realm of existence. The War of Troy occurred roughly in the 5th generation of this era. A generation later saw the last of the heroes perish, the gods leave the mortal realm to reside on Olympus, and the Mycenaean world plunge into the dark age of history. Unfortunately, only the Iliad and Odyssey remain extant of the original 8 works that made up the epic cycle, but luckily many of the playwrights of classical Athens used these, now lost works, as reference material for classical tragedies that have come down to us complete. Referring to the beginning, the war, and the aftermath of the Trojan conflict, Euripides, Aeschylus, and Sophocles reference the works heavily in their tragedies. There is also an epitome, or summary, of the lost epics known as the Chrestomathy by Proclus, which provides an outline for the lost epics and helps us to understand the greater conflict. Lastly, there are also summaries of ancient Greek myth by Apollodorus of Athens, and Gaius Julius Hyginus, who wrote in the 2nd century BCE and the 2nd century CE, respectively, that provide invaluable information on Helen's life. This leaves us with fragments of Helen's life scattered over a vast array of authorship, style, and temporality. At first, I was daunted by the task of synthesizing it all down into something resembling a biography of a mythical, numinous being like Helen. Turns out, I relished every minute of it. Across all the material, there is often contradictions in the sources. Where and when this occurs, if relevant, I'll mention the multiplicity of information, but will do my best to construct a chronological and plausible life for her, bearing in mind her existence is probably fantastical. Homer will be used as a lodestone during this investigation, constructing the narrative based off the bare bones of the story he introduces. If I encounter anything that contradicts the father of Greek epic, I'll discount it as spurious. That may or may not be the case, but in the interests of concision, that will be my rule for engagement with Helen. All that said, let's begin the story in earnest. The tale begins in the middle of the Age of Heroes, with the conception of the woman whose face would go on to launch those 1,000 ships. It will come as no surprise to many people listening that our old friend Zeus had a hand, or should I say wing, in the Genesis story of Helen. Her mortal parents were the king and queen of Sparta, Tyndareus and Leda, and they both had semi-divine origins of their own. Tyndareus could claim descent from the original founders of Sparta, King Lacedaemon, and the queen, Sparta, namesake of the city itself. Leda was the granddaughter, through her father, of none other than Ares, the god of war. A lofty pedigree indeed, but it was not for Tyndareus to be the biological father of Helen, as Leda had, through her renowned beauty, attracted the attention of the god-king residing on Mount Olympus. Zeus made his move as Leda went to the banks of the Eurotas River to bathe, and changing himself into a magnificent swan, flew into the wife of Tyndareus's naked embrace and impregnated her with his divine seed. It is a scene that has provided much inspiration to ancient artists, medieval and modern alike, and tends to be depicted as one of romantic seduction, particularly during the Renaissance when religious morals prevented any depiction of mortal love. It was a convenient way to represent eroticism. Personally, I don't buy into the propaganda around the event and have read time and again of Zeus imposing his desires upon man, woman, boy, and girl alike. So, it was through unrequested advance and rape that Helen was conceived on the banks of the river named for the legendary king who dug the channel to the sea, draining the marshes of the Laconian plain in the process. It is said that on that same day, Helen's future mother also lay with her husband, and I would suggest this occurred before Zeus's assault, as I doubt anyone would be feeling amorous afterwards. Whichever, on that day, Leda carried within her both mortal and immortal seed, and as time passed, and much to the surprise of her and her husband, she gave birth to an egg. When the egg hatched, it bore within its shell two boys and two girls. The boys were to be called Castor and Polydeuces, and the girls, Clytemnestra and Helen. Although a highly unlikely vessel for human gestation, the famous travel writer Pausanias mentions seeing the very egg in Sparta on his trip through the Peloponnese in the 2nd century CE. By this date, Sparta had become a tourist attraction for rich Romans and Greeks alike, and the egg recorded was probably an imported ostrich egg from North Africa. Before moving on, I should mention that many versions of the legend say there are two eggs, but regardless of how many eggs Leda lay, the Roman period Spartans only deemed Helen's worthy of display. For our young hatchlings, the boys, as stated in Book 3 of the Iliad, were sons of Leda and Zeus, though they had an interesting form of mortality. Homer lays out in Book 11 of the Odyssey that the twins share that immortality whereby they die and come to life again, each one of them every other day throughout all time. Most later sources suggest that Castor was mortal and the son of Tyndareus, and Polydeuces was immortal and of Zeus. Homer's contemporary Hesiod indicates that they were both the progeny of Zeus. Either way, like Helen, they were famous throughout the Mediterranean, particularly in Rome and Etruria. We have already met Clytemnestra and heard of the revenge she took upon her husband, Agamemnon, for the deceit he concocted in sacrificing their daughter, Iphigenia. She seems to be the only true scion of Leda and her mortal husband. As for Helen, in the Iliad, Homer clearly states, also in Book 3, that she is the daughter of Zeus, and this appears to be irrefutable in most other sources. After such a mystical beginning, the story of Helen of Sparta goes dark for a number of years, and throughout the sources, her life in general is one of moments punctuated by male transgression. We learn nothing further of this singular figure's story until, like her mother, she was espied upon the banks of the Eurotas River outside of Sparta. The one who watched Helen dance by the waterside was none other than Theseus, a towering figure in Bronze Age Greek mythology and the most famous king of ancient Athens. His life and deeds would fill a biography of their own and would indeed be an interesting one to tell if this was the Athenian History Podcast. So, to summarise his life briefly, he came out of the relative obscurity of his birth in the Trozen, an area in the northeastern Peloponnese, to assume his rightful place as prince consort of Athens. Completing six labours in the process of his journey to the city, and mopping up some of the miscreants missed by Heracles in his own labours. At that time, Athens was forced to pay a debt of blood to mighty King Minos, who resided on Crete, whereby every 9 years, in the form of seven boys and seven girls drawn by lot, they would be sent to that island. On Crete, it seems these children were fed to a strange creature known as the Minotaur, who resided in a labyrinth near Knossos, King Minos's capital city. Despite his father's protestations, Theseus resolved to make himself the seventh boy on the next tribute ship to depart. Reassuring his father, not only would he be successful, he would fly a white flag from his ship to alert his worried father of success as he sailed back into Athens. Whilst on Crete, he seduced Minos's daughter Ariadne, who gave him a magical ball of twine with which to navigate the labyrinth and find his way out. It must be said that I think this ball of twine wasn't magical at all. It seems to have behaved in a rather nondescript fashion. Digressions aside, he killed the Minotaur, literally Minos's bull in Greek, rescued the children, and made off with the king's daughter to boot. On his way home, he would leave her on the island of Naxos due to a prophecy, and with a troubled mind return to Athens, forgetting his promise to his father, King Aegeus, in the process. Not seeing the white flag on the ship's mast, the king, who had been looking out for him daily, lost his mind to grief and assumed Theseus dead. Casting himself into the sea and to his death, an event so dramatic that we still call the sea the Aegean to this day. This ship was said to be cared for by the citizens of Athens, even down to the time of the 5th century BCE, its timbers and ropes being replaced as they rotted, and gives form to the Theseus ship paradox, which is a thought experiment for modern philosophers. The supposition is that if all parts of an object are replaced, is the object in question really the original? From there, Theseus was risen to the kingship and set about unifying the tribes and turning the city into a metropolis rather than a collection of villages. He would travel to the land of the Amazons, seduce and make off with their queen Hippolyta, to marry her in the Athenian Acropolis. The first Amazon to ever marry, her people would repay this betrayal by marching to Athens in force and siege the city. Theseus led the defence and beat off his wife's people, only to afterwards set her aside and marry another woman. A spurned Hippolyta attacked the wedding ceremony in rage, and Theseus would end in killing his former wife in single combat. This new wife, Phaedra, was in fact the sister of the Athenian champion's former lover Ariadne, but she would not meet the fate of her new husband's previous lovers and would, moreover, turn the tables, leaving him for his son from the union with the Amazon queen. Are you still with me? Good. He didn't go on from there to invent a longer-lasting light bulb, but now in the twilight of his life he was still not done with his wicked philandering ways, and I'll quote here from the introduction of the Greek historian Plutarch's Life of Theseus. Of the world's two most illustrious cities, Rome and Athens, Romulus founded the one, and Theseus made a city of the other, and each resorted to the rape of women. End quote. He then made a pact with a bosom buddy to marry a daughter of Zeus and beget more children, despite having many progenies already to numerous women. It was this deal that brought him to Sparta with his gaze firmly locked on the daughter of Leda. He was said to be 50 by this stage, and Helen, barely 13. This is how it came to pass that the mighty, though lecherous, Theseus watched our Helen by the waterside and became entranced, as all men were bound to do, by her semi-divine beauty. Accompanied as he was by the aforementioned bosom buddy, Pirithous, the two snatched Helen as she was dancing at the temple of Artemis Orthia, a jewel goddess with portfolios expanding through motherhood, children, hunting, fertility, and the dawn. From 700 BCE, at the beginning of the Archaic Age, young Spartan girls would dance naked in strange rites designed to celebrate the onset of puberty. To date, over 100,000 lead votive offerings have been unearthed at the site. It is believed some of these tokens depict Helen herself. Perhaps these girls on the cusp of womanhood were dancing in honour of their most famous ancestor Helen and her own time spent by the river. Either way, Theseus and co. made fast their getaway from Sparta, retreating to Attica and its capital city, where he locked the prisoner in a mountain fortress named Aphidna. The plan was to wait for her to reach marriageable age, and to guard Helen, the Athenian left his mother, Aethra, in charge of the girl. The deal with Pirithous had been that both would marry a daughter of Zeus, and by the law of reciprocity, Theseus then left with his friend for the underworld, as their next target was Persephone, who resided in Hades. This invasion into Spartan lands and the subsequent abduction of one of its princesses was a double insult and an outright, though underhanded, declaration of war by the Athenian king. Helen's twin brothers, mighty already despite their years, raised an army and invaded Athenian territory, bent on her retrieval. They laid waste the regions of Attica and besieged mighty Athens, demanding the return of their fair sister. The citizens could not comply with the requests of Castor and Polydeuces, for they didn't know where she was, and Theseus, who did, was trapped in the underworld by that stage. Then it happened that some of the men from the area of Decelea, within which the fortress of Aphidna was located, contrived to assist the brothers in locating Helen. They stormed the mountainous redoubt, rescuing her from captivity, and turned the tables on Theseus by carrying off his own mother back to Sparta. True to form, the Athenian king left his mother to languish in Laconia, and in Book 3 of the Iliad, Homer has Aethra as one of the Spartan princess's maidservants, following her around the war-torn streets of Troy. This assistance from the men of Decelea was the reason that during the Peloponnesian War, at least 8 centuries after the Trojan War, the Spartan armies left the region alone whilst all other areas of Athens were riven with destruction. After this, the first of her abductions, Helen would return safely back to Sparta, but for Theseus, once he eventually returned from his quest, was much hated by his subjects for the hurt his lust brought upon them. He went into self-imposed exile on the island of Skidos and was promptly thrown off a cliff to his death. Boo, Theseus. Boo. We know almost nothing of Helen's disposition during this first forced removal of her life, but being a young girl, raised in relative luxury and isolation within her father's palace, we can assume that the experience was a terrifying one. Would she at this point have realized the danger her Zeus-given gifts could cause? How many nights did she spend agonizing over what her fate would be once Theseus returned from the underworld, and how joyous must her reunion with her family have been after the ordeal? I imagine that there would have been many sleepless nights in the Tower of Aphidna, with many tears shed against the shoulder of her captor's mother, Aethra, her only confidant during this time. As fate would play out, similar episodes would repeat throughout her life, and although she often bemoaned her lot, she never broke. Her spirit was made strong through such tribulations. In this story, we see that even at the tender age of 13, Helen and her beauty could and would make people go to war to possess it. As before, after such an eventful occurrence, the story of the most beautiful woman in the world goes silent, until it again becomes punctuated by the next man who would attain the beauty fathered by Zeus and Leda. That next man was, as Homer referred to him, Menelaus, the son of Atreus. He would become her first husband. At the time of her courtship and marriage, Helen and Menelaus were not unknown to each other. As I mentioned in a previous episode, he and his brother Agamemnon had sought refuge with King Tyndareus of Sparta after their cousin Aegisthus had killed their father and forced them into exile. I believe it was perhaps during this period that the future king and queen of Sparta first met, and even fell in love. No source suggests this, but it fits the timeline nicely. Also, as Helen's account fades from history after the Trojan War, Homer indicates that at the very least there is a deep respect between the two, and at most, an abiding love. Regardless, they certainly would have encountered one another, and when a Spartan army assisted Agamemnon in removing his treacherous cousin from his own throne, Helen's sister Clytemnestra was given to the new king of Mycenae in marriage to seal the deal of alliance between that kingdom and Sparta. The elephant in the room for King Tyndareus was an unmarried Helen residing in his court. Recent events had proven that men of power would go to great lengths for her and the legendary beauty that came with it. His plan to ameliorate this issue seems to have backfired on the aging king. Sending out heralds to announce his intention to marry her off, he didn't anticipate the renown with which she was already held across Greater Greece. Before he knew it, some of the most badass kings and princes descended on Sparta to press their claim, all believing themselves the most worthy and all being capable of great violence if spurned. We are fortunate to have surviving, albeit in fragments, a work attributed to our old friend Hesiod called The Catalogue of Women. In Book 5, although riddled with lacuna, Hesiod lays out 12 of the probably 30 suitors who attempted to win Helen's hand in marriage. Among them came Idomeneus of Crete, who would go on to be one of the Achaean heroes within the Trojan horse and return to his island home uninjured and bathed in glory. Ajax the Great was there too. As we have seen, he also would fight at Troy but would end his own life through the perceived dishonour of losing the right to the dead Achilles' arms and armour. Philoctetes, the most revered archer of the land, presented his hand as well, along with Elephenor of Evia, the former being instrumental in the fall of Troy and the latter falling dead upon the fields of that holy city in the ninth year of the war. These and the other contestants all brought gifts of treasure and bequests, save two. Odysseus brought nothing, for it was said that he knew Menelaus would win, but the complicated man always had an agenda. There was another Spartan royal at Tyndareus's court that had captivated his attention already. Tyndareus had a brother, Icarius, who had a daughter named Penelope, and as we've already seen, this cousin of Helen would go on to be the wife of Mr. Polytropos. The other who didn't offer presents was Menelaus himself. Well, he didn't offer them personally, for he had sent his brother, the king of Mycenae, in his stead. Agamemnon did indeed bring elaborate gifts with which to win the daughter of Zeus. The reason for his brother's absence is not made clear in the sources. My personal theory is that he and Helen were already deeply in love, and his appearance might have made the fact obvious to the others, causing an immediate outbreak in hostilities. Tyndareus, like Penelope, who later played a delicate balancing act with her 108 suitors, neither accepted or received any of the gifts through fear of causing offence to the rejected parties. As always, it seems, Odysseus had a solution to the problem, and would the Spartan king forward his own interests with Penelope, he could solve the issue at hand. The plan was a simple one, and it involved all present swearing an oath that should any attempt to take Helen by force once she was married, they would all band together for her retrieval. This was to become the pretense for the Trojan War after Paris had made off with Menelaus's wife. Tyndareus readily agreed to this, as did the interested parties, as they all thought they would be the one to win the hand of Helen. Hesiod tells us that the Spartan king sacrificed a horse in order to formalize the oath between all the respected and interested parties. The sources are varied on what occurred next. In some it is mentioned that everyone drew straws to decide the winner. This seems ridiculous. Others mentioned that there were contests of strength and speed, but if so, how did Menelaus win if he was still in Mycenae? Most, however, declare that due to the magnificence of the gift sent, Helen was ultimately awarded to Menelaus as his wife. This last theory, I believe, supports my earlier assumption that the two were already in love. Coupled with that, a Roman author called Gaius Julius Hyginus mentioned that Helen was allowed by her father to place a wreath on whomever she wished to marry. In story 78 of Hyginus' Fables, she places the wreath on Menelaus. Finally, in an epitome written on the works of Apollodorus of Athens, we are told that Tyndareus chose the son of Atreus and in turn solicited Icarius to allow Odysseus to marry Penelope. Whatever the case, the end result was the same, and the oath of Tyndareus, as it is called, allowed the spurned suitors to return home with honour intact. Another stroke of brilliance on behalf of Odysseus, the man of twists and turns. Once more, those same sources are silent on what Helen thought of the whole event, but we can infer much by the evidence presented. Firstly, and most interestingly for me, kingly power was passed on matrilineally in this ancient Mycenaean Sparta. As although she had two mighty brothers, when Leda and Tyndareus passed away or abdicated, it was Menelaus and Helen who would be king and queen of the Laconians. Whether this was common in the Bronze Age, I can't say for sure, but it is certainly telling in this instance and aligns nicely with the degree of liberation women had in the later classical phase of Spartan history. Secondly, this time, regardless of what degree of control she had over this marriage, Helen would not be forced to leave her homeland and could rely on the oath and her new husband for protection in this male-dominated world. That husband was a man of passion, who would war for over a decade to gain her back from Paris, and the sense I got from the Iliad is that he was a man of honour. Homer applies various epithets to him, such as warlike, spear-famed, loved by Ares, and cherished by Zeus. We can imagine that long into the night the nuptial celebrations continued, with a cast littered with fame not to be repeated until the funeral games of Achilles. The Greek word symposium means a gathering of people drinking together, and you can imagine many the libation was poured in propitiation to the gods and the oath they all shared. With the radiant Helen watching on, merely sipping well-watered wine, all the while wondering what the goddess Fate had in store for her next. In the short term, it seems like a happy marriage and the birth of her only child, Hermione. The stories abound of other children, one even to Theseus during her abduction, but Homer and Hesiod both state she only had one child. Hesiod even mentions in the closing stages of Book 5 in his catalogue of women, and I quote, "Helen bore Hermione in the palace, a child unlooked for." Why unlooked for is not made clear, but it might have been that Helen was considered barren, and a child was an unexpected, though pleasant, surprise. This daughter would go on to be a beauty in her own right, marry a son of Agamemnon, and become queen alongside him in Sparta after her parents depart to Hades. Once again, this son, Orestes, will only gain kingly power in Sparta after marrying a Spartan princess. However, Hermione and her allure would always be overshadowed by her mother. And I'll quote here from Sappho, a female poet of the island of Lesbos who composed in the 6th and 7th centuries BCE to display the comparison in action. "For when I look at you face to face, not even Hermione seems to be like you, and to compare you to golden-haired Helen is not unseemly." Known as the 10th Muse, unfortunately, due to the homoerotic nature of her works, Sappho today only survives in fragments, considered too scandalous for the many Christian scribes copying and preserving ancient literature in the Middle Ages. Much of her work is lost, even though it borders on the sublime. But we can see in that passage that she considered Hermione's beauty secondary to Helen's. Where to next? Well, that isn't the purview of this part of Helen's life, and the next major event in it is one well known to my exceptionally intelligent audience and will turn her from Helen of Sparta to Helen of Troy. Her wedding to Menelaus is an epochal occurrence and one that Hesiod links with the closing stages of the Age of Heroes. Nothing occurred within the realm of man without the machinations of the gods, and the closing of this age was merely the fulfillment of Zeus's designs. As we've already heard in a seemingly ambiguous line from the opening stanza of the Iliad, which I'll quote again now to redraw your attention to it, "And the will of Zeus was moving to its end." Hesiod gives an indication as to the will of Olympian Zeus in the very last lines of the Catalogue of Women, and I quote here from that passage. "Now, all the gods were divided through strife, For at that very time Zeus, who thunders on high, was meditating marvellous deeds, even to mingle storm and tempest over the boundless earth. And already he was hastening to make an utter end of the race of mortal men, declaring that he would destroy the lives of the demigods, that the children of the gods should not mate with the wretched mortals, seeing their fate with their own eyes, but that the blessed gods henceforth, even as aforetime, should have their living and their habitations apart from men. But on those who were born of immortals and of mankind, verily Zeus laid toil and sorrow upon sorrow. As we'll see in next month's episode, Zeus began plotting mankind's woe well before the wedding of Helen and Menelaus, but its consummation set the fate of the Greek heroes on the path to the Trojan War. The oath of Tyndareus bound them to that fate, and as I mentioned earlier, a generation after the heroes were dead, fodder for song, the gods retreated to Olympus, never to walk the land again. Before I go, I'd like to paint a little what-if for you, if I may. Imagine the stony halls of the Mycenaean Megaron of Sparta, the fire well banked in its central hearth. Menelaus and Helena upon their thrones, drinking, eating, and keeping young Hermione from underfoot, all the while listening to a rhapsode singing of Perseus and the Golden Fleece. Suddenly, a herald storms through the doors, excitement written on his expression. The rhapsode ceases to sing, and all eyes turn to this messenger. Menelaus speaks. "Pray, do tell what event has precipitated your disturbing of our revelry." To which the herald nervously replied, "My king and queen, a ship has docked at the port of Helos, and on it are two Trojan princes who wish an immediate audience." Helen inquired as to which two princes, as the king of Troy had a great many sons indeed. There was a strange stillness in the air as the herald responded, "My lord and my lady, it is Prince Aeneas, the great-hearted, and his brother Paris, the magnificent." Thanks so much, dear listeners, for your time. I hope you enjoyed this look into Helen's formative years as much as I did in putting it all together. Join me on March the 1st as we move into the next phase of her life and part 2 of The Face That Launched 1,000 Ships, Helen of Troy. Until then, take good care and speak soon. Ooh, that was just so much fun. I'm positively buzzing after it. During the research for this, my partner joked with me that were Helen not mythical, or at the very least 3,000 years dead and buried, she may have had an issue with me spending so much time with another woman. To which I calmly replied, "You are my Helen, dearest." Smooth, right? Please check out my website, SpartanHistoryPodcast.com, where I have extra information, photos, and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_History, and on Facebook too at SpartanHistoryPodcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from, and leave a review. Enjoy the outro. See you next time.